Okay, let's get this show on the road. Good afternoon. Welcome to this interesting little session. What did we call it again?
War driving.
Oh, yes. Okay, war driving specifically. Yes. You probably heard from Randall yesterday what not to do, so I'm about to tell you how to do it. So we're going to talk a little bit about wireless technology, specifically wireless LAN technology, the explosion of it, kind of some of the things you should and should not be doing if you want to use it at home, and give a little bit of a demonstration. Just a quick show of hands, how many people in this room have, either at home or at work, or use in some form or another, a wireless network? Cool! Now, the interesting thing is, if I'd asked that question last year, how many of you would put your hands up? 2 years ago? Right. So in virtually 24 months, we've gone from, you know, a select group of relatively literate, you know, geek-type audience people with a small handful to almost 100% coverage. Now, this really is an interesting sort of hockey stick effect on the technology. But in the rush to get it enabled and set up, a lot of people forget a few things. Not least of which is security. Anybody here not understand that a wireless LAN is a radio? You'd be surprised how many people don't, particularly those who wear suits and make decisions and sign checks. Point number one is a wireless LAN is a radio. Now, admittedly, if you want to go into the technical specs, it's spread spectrum, it's digital, so it's relatively immune to interference, unlike, say, for example, the other radio-type technologies that you can buy at Walmart, like your family radio services, you know, handset. Incidentally, we were having fun with that last night, scanning through the frequencies to see exactly who at the con was using it, and screaming out things like blue giraffes, you know, too many blue giraffes while this was happening. I think we confused a few people, and our very own Johnny X also managed to convince some people that he had a much better, more secure wireless technology to sell them relatively cheaply next year. So, in a digital form, we have the same problem with wireless networking. It's open, it's standardized, everybody knows how to connect to it. Now, what you're looking at on the screen right now is a program called NetStumbler. Anybody here heard of NetStumbler? Right. Anybody here heard of AirSnort? Right. Okay, for those who didn't put their hands in the air, these are both programs that are essentially are, in networking terms, sniffers. They look at what's out there and display the results. Now, what's interesting here is two things. One, I'm only using the built-in antenna on the network card that I've got here. This is a Lucent compatible card. Of the relative cards that are out there, probably Lucent and Cisco cards have the best built-in antennas on the cards, because if you think about it in radio terms, sitting horizontally next to a whole chunk of high-frequency electronics, i.e. your laptop or your PC, is the worst possible place to put an antenna. So that's why the coverage on the internal antennas is not necessarily as good as it could be. But if we look at a sniffer, we'll see two interesting things here. One, we're picking up the access point that I just set up here. Okay, that's why it's a nice, strong signal. Okay, because there's like about 2 feet of air separating the two antennas here. But what's even more interesting is that I set up an access point yesterday so we could get broadband access from this room. And that is not showing up on the scan. Okay, why? Anybody know? I'm not beaconing my SSID. Thank you. Somebody does know what I'm talking about. So, what is an SSID? You can see it listed here. All right, system station ID. Basically, it's the network name. All right. Now, bear in mind that wireless networking works just like regular Ethernet conceptually, because on top of the wireless network, you have to run something else. In this case, TCP/IP. Which is what almost everybody runs. You can, if you choose, run things like Novell or NetBIOS on top, and those have their uses. But most people run IP on top of wireless. So, 802.11b you can think of as the equivalent of the cable and the base level protocols that put it together. So just because I can see something doesn't necessarily mean I can use it. To actually be able to use a connection, and by the way, everything I'm going to talk about here has a real legitimate use as well as things that you know, may not necessarily want to legally admit to doing. So for anybody in law enforcement who's present, there's nothing completely illegal about anything I'm going to say here. So if, from the point of view of setting up your own network, you have to set up an SSID, your equipment will frequently come with one already provided for you. And most people then leave it at that. Now the problem with that is that once, if I run a sniffer program, and in fact some of the utilities that are built into Windows XP, that are built into Mac OS X, and so forth, will even scan for SSIDs. So it's not really much of protection, setting a non-default SSID. In fact, I've likened it to being about as much protection as a plastic padlock. You know, sort of like little kitty ones with three tumblers that you get in McDonald's Happy Meals. So, that said, it's still a good idea to create your own SSID, not least of which because it makes debugging your network a lot more useful. Because I happen to know that DASI over there is mine. So if it shows up on any of the scans, I know that that particular ID is mine. Now the other pieces of information the NetStumbler can pick up, you can see there are the MAC address, which is, if you like, the very low level, wire level network address of the equipment. Every piece of networking equipment that runs an Ethernet-like protocol has a MAC address, short for Media Access Control, if you didn't know. And really, you can think of this as like the physical address, right? It's set by the equipment manufacturer, and manufacturers are allocated a block of addresses specified by the first three bytes of the address. So NetStumbler is telling me because the first three bytes here are 00022D, it knows that the vendor of this particular device is Aguirre Systems, Lucent was the previous name, and then they changed the product name to Orinoco. By the way, if you own Lucent stock, you will have been already familiar with this roller coaster. Why they continuously change the names, I don't know. So if you're searching for equipment on PriceWatch to buy cheaply, Aguirre, Lucent, Orinoco all mean exactly the same thing. Additionally, this is probably the most widely OEM'd equipment of anybody out there in the EDA211B field. My network cards happen to be OEM by Hewlett-Packard. You'll find them from Compaq. You'll find them from all sorts of people out there on the net. You also may see the name Avaya, which is the other brand name. However, they're all distinguished by the fact that they kind of look rather clunky on the back. They've got that square end, and they've got the original Lucent Waveland sort of embossed into the plastic. The key point to this is that if you find one with an obscure brand name for cheap, buy it. It'll take the latest and greatest official firmware quite happily, because nobody really bothers to put custom firmware on these things, because the ones that Lucent provide work just fine. So the other thing, information that NetStumbler is putting up here in nice user-friendly form, is what type of device this is. This is an access point. That's what the AP stands for. WEP. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Wired Equivalency Protocol. When the standard was created, there was obviously a certain amount of concern about security. However, there was also a certain amount of concern about the processing overhead and the cost associated with encrypting the links. There's also, if you're a conspiracy theorist, the possibility that various organizations didn't want encryption put in place that they couldn't crack, etc. Either way, what we wound up with is essentially two levels of wire level security. Now you may hear them referred to as 40-bit or 64-bit encryption, the reason being that 40-bit is actually the number of bits that you can set. The others are provided as part of the MAC in the key that's used for encryption. The other is referred to as 128-bit, but again, that's not the full 128 bits. Do the 40 less 64, do the math, it's the same number of bits that are actually provided by the hardware as a unique key. So You've also probably, in fact, let me ask that question. How many people here have sort of heard concerns about cracking wireless security? Okay, this is good. I like an educated audience. All right, very briefly, how many people worry about the fact that they may have their wireless security cracked at home? Oh, that's one or two. You have nothing to worry about. Why? Because the cracking approach required to get into wireless equivalent privacy protocol, in other words, to crack the wire, is dependent upon logging, if you like, the acquisition frames. In other words, when a computer associates with the network and effectively logs on to the wireless net protocol. How many times do you power up and connect your laptop a day at home? Anybody? 3-4 times, a couple of hundred if you're running Windows Me.
And thanks for zero.
Okay, so the point is, you're not doing it often enough to get a good capture streak. You're going to notice the person in your driveway with one of these on the roof rack, parked there for 3 weeks, gathering the data to try and crack your web address.
What if they get a pink Pringles can?
Or the Pringles can, or anything else. More on antennas in a moment. So, really, for home usage, even 40-bit encryption is more than sufficient to give a reasonable expectation of privacy. However, if we're talking about a commercial environment, small business, large business, whatever, no, it's not sufficient. Because if you can imagine you're covering an office of 30 people who are sort of mobile users, they're going to log on and log off the office network quite a lot. So it's pretty much standard practice now that you should treat a wireless LAN link, even if WEP is enabled over it, as an insecure link. So from a corporate policy perspective, treat it just like you would the internet. Now, there are several ways of doing this. You can either run SSH to everything over there, you can put a firewall up, and in fact, a lot of people simply set up a wireless network completely separate from the rest of their corporate net and require you to go through a VPN gateway to get into the rest of the network. Anybody here not know what a VPN is? Virtual private network, an encrypted tunnel that's set up in addition on top of the wireless equivalent protocol. In fact, I know a couple of companies that have actually not bothered to turn WEP on their network because of processing overhead concerns and said, why bother? Because everybody that logs through our network is going to go into the VPN gateway. So everything is encrypted over that. What's the problem with that model? No, it's not gateway through to the internet, so you're not getting free bandwidth to anybody, but you're still leaving the client machines that are connected to the system easily open to attack. All right? So, you know, having the VP of sales DOS'd off your wireless network, even though in fact nobody cracked the corporate net, is still probably not going to enhance your job prospects. So, that's a little bit about security. You can also assign most equipment names. Now, that's the other thing that's worth doing is if you buy equipment for home use, you'll find typically most access points are the same product line that's used in the corporate environment. Hop onto the company's website and go and grab the corporate level tools for download. Why? Because they're not idiot proof. They don't rely on Java and browsers, and they generally work better. The downside is they're probably going to require you to be running Windows. So in this particular case, this is a Lucent OEM'd Residential Gateway 1000 sitting right here. It internally actually doesn't contain anything complicated. Lucent has a habit of creating access points that actually just they plug regular cards into. So inside that shark fin is one of these. Incidentally, anybody here use an Apple AirPort? Yeah, they're exactly the same thing. Okay, the AirPort and the RG1000 are the same guts, just a slightly different form factor, and I've got to admit the Apple UFO is a lot cooler looking. However, one of the advantages to this is the fact that all of the Lucent cards have a antenna socket on the back. A lot of cards from other vendors don't. You probably can't see this in the dark, but there's a tiny little circle in the middle of the card with a completely custom and proprietary connector in there. More about where you can get connectors for that in a moment. So when you're shopping for an access point for home use, bear those sorts of things in mind. Now, what sort of range can you expect out of an access point at home? Well, it's not unreasonable to go through two or maybe even three floors worth of wood construction. Fortunately, here in the U.S., most homes are wood frame and gypsum board or whatever. It's a little more difficult in Europe, where there's a lot more concrete, steel, autoclave cement used in home construction, rather than a lot less wood. So the other point is, anybody want to guess what the biggest source of interference for 802.11b networks is? Cordless phones and microwaves. Okay. So you'll find that if you can't connect to the access point from a particular point of your part of your house, just mentally work out if there is a microwave or a cordless phone in direct line of sight between the two. Move the access point or your client, and you'll probably obviate the problem. Most of the current crop of firmware contains algorithms specifically for getting around microwaves, but it really is like trying to shine your laser pointer through a 100-watt bulb. Okay, it's a little difficult. The other point is, if you are going to run a cordless phone at home, don't get a 2.4 gig phone. Okay, buy a 900 megahertz phone. You can get some very nice 900 megahertz spread spectrum digital phones, and as a bonus, they're typically cheaper than the 2.4 gig models too. And the coverage is about the same. Yeah.
What about 802.11a?
I'll talk about A in a moment. I'm covering mostly. Yeah. If we're going to ask questions, can we get the mic out to people?
Sorry,
okay.
Yeah,
good.
Mike.
Yes. He's there. Just call him Mike. Isn't that right? Nobody. All right. So those are a couple of the practical things in setting up a home network and a corporate network. So, what is war driving? War driving, the word, comes from the old war dialing hack of word, which was basically sitting there having your machine dial a bunch of numbers looking for modems. War driving is sticking an 802.11b equipped laptop in your car, preferably with a nice big antenna attached to it for better reception, and heading out looking for wireless networks. Now, using a program either like NetStumbler or AirSnort or some of the others, I'm going to show you some of the an example of a war drive. This was going from where I happened to be working that day home, with my laptop in the front seat of my car with this antenna plugged in pointing out the front window. So it's not exactly an ideal reception. Now, you can see the number of networks I managed to pick up here. I'm not going to hazard a guess as to who these belong to, but it's not that hard given some of the rather obvious names that they've attached to them. A couple of things that are worth interesting noting here. I like the fact that somebody called their network Sugar. A bunch of people have left the default SSIDs on, and what is truly scary about this is this column. Okay. Only three of these links are encrypted. Okay. The default condition for most access points as shipped is to not turn on encryption. Why? Because it results in money calls to customer support, because you have to set up default encryption keys. You really want people to change them before they start using them, and it's just one more parameter for people to screw up when they install their wireless network card. So what was done here is not technically illegal. Right? It's not illegal to go around and look for radio signals. Yet. Okay? It's not illegal to pick up this information, because it is essentially broadcast. Now, please note, I said technically. Nobody has yet taken this to trial. I do not want to be a test case, neither do you. Right, Randall?
Right.
Okay, this is a nasty, messy process. So, if there is any chance whatsoever that you're going to wind up dealing with law enforcement, destroy all evidence that you ever tried, because it's really not worth sticking to the point. Yes, question at the back there. Mike Boyd.
Why wouldn't scanning this network fall under the same thing that scanners fall under? You know, it's being broadcast, it's radio waves. Do you have any right to listen in on it as long as you're just monitoring?
because it involves that politician scaring thing called a computer. Right. Anyway, the band that's in use here, incidentally, is the scientific and home use band. So it's not covered by a lot of the FCC regulations. Downside of that is you have to accept any interference that comes along. You can't bitch about that too badly. But you're correct, essentially correct. It's covered by all of the same laws. So the fact that a number of people don't do this, as I said, picking up this information is not illegal. What is illegal, all right, is logging on to that person's network. Okay. Even if they've left it wide open, all right, I am not legally allowed to walk up to, let's say the GSBA building, and pick up their boardroom network and hop onto their corporate LAN. Okay, this is called breaking and entering. And people with far more legal training than I will ever hope to achieve have basically stated this over and over again. It's not illegal to pick up the address or the broadcast or the beacons. It is illegal to associate with a network and log on. Now, exactly at which point of the 802.11b protocol you cross that line is a little fuzzy because, again, it's never been tested in court. So, providing you stick to pretty much picking up this information, you're doing okay. It's much along the same lines as if somebody had left their door open and their house unlocked and you walked in and sat down decided to watch the game on television, okay, because you weren't asked in, that is an illegal act. Okay. Question at the back there. Hold it. Wait for the mic.
I'm aware that to some degree there's a large number of people who are using these for their home networks who don't mind other people using their networks and actually publish their location on the internet. You said that this could be breaking and entering. It seems more like a trespassing if there's no weapon able, no effort to prevent it. I guess what I'm curious about is what the danger is of utilizing things in the public area if you're not intentionally causing any damage or inflicting harm on the client.
Were you here for Randall's talk yesterday? A cautionary tale? There is the legal theory and the practical implication. Mike Boyd, could you get that to Randall, please? I think you can probably sum it up in two sentences or less.
The really brief version is that in most states in the U.S., it's a felony to alter or access a computer without authorization, and they've defined authorized as being very vague, and they've defined alter as being very vague, so you can really go down bad. Three felonies for me, so, yeah.
Particularly considering an access point is classed as a computer. There's a 386 processor in this thing.
Just to follow up on that, if anybody's been paying attention to what's been going on in New York with the New York Wireless, where people have been getting together and making a community and posting it on the internet, your service providers don't like it either.
Yeah.
It's not very,
exactly
it's not very
right.
good.
It's not, that's the other point, is that you may be perfectly willing to share your bandwidth. Your service provider probably isn't. And in actual fact, unless you have your ISP is one of a very small select group of fairly small ISPs that encourage this, it is against the terms of service that you signed when you signed up for your ISP. Now, they don't have to provide you with DSL or cable modem service. So, you know, if you'd violate the TOSs, the simplest thing they're going to do is probably just shut up your service. So, that said, there are a large number of people out there trying to cover the public spaces of the world and our cities with 802.11b networks for public access. Now, what hasn't been particularly well thought out is how do you identify a public network? There's been a sort of rather interesting phenomenon arrived called war chalking, which consists of a set of symbols, and you can look it up if you go into, oops. Didn't look good. If you look up war chalking in Google, you'll probably find a couple of examples of it. Let me just, that is stopped. Good. But essentially, it consists of, as the name would suggest, people who have done war driving going out and sort of putting up these almost hobo-like hobo signs about an available network. Oops, I've associated with the wrong network here. This one's not connected to anything. Oops. One moment. You may also ask, somebody I think asked earlier, why am I using Windows XP? I'm not a Linux bigot. This machine does dual boot, but I have to say that the support for wireless infrastructure in both XP and Mac OS X is way better than the support in Linux in terms of ease of use. The other problem here, of course, though, is that XP goes looking for known networks or networks that beacon rather than ones that don't and picks them up in the orders that they are here. Anyway, I'll reconnect to the network in a moment. But war chalking consists of putting up a series of symbols that kind of looks like two semicircles upside down, and it's got specific places for putting the name of the network and things like that. But that, again, that is not a legally viable long-term strategy for saying here is a publicly accessible wireless network. What's going to happen is that there's going to have to be some agreement. There's probably going to have to be incorporated into one of the standards that are coming out, because 802.11b is just one of many. I'll talk about A in a moment, and G, that sort of will probably specify an SSID name as a publicly accessible network. So something like public might be a good choice, or internet, or something along those lines, as a notification that this is a publicly accessible wireless access point with a broadband connection. What's also interesting from a technology perspective in terms of getting broadband coverage everywhere, there's a lot of academic research and corporate research going into what are called mesh networks right now. A mesh network is different from the current environment, because what happens now is it's still the classic hub and spoke model. I have access points with broadband connections to which clients attach. In a mesh network model, my packet might bounce, for example, from my PC to your PC to her PC, through a couple of PDAs and a cell phone or two before it hits an access point with a broadband connection and gets on the network. A lot of the protocols are still experimental, a lot of work going on there, but the net effect of this is to expand the coverage and take advantage of the fact that the processing power is effectively becoming extremely cheap and very widespread. So to participate in the network, you donate a little bit of your machine's processing power and network bandwidth to passing packets for other people. And the effect is you can turn the range of, say, a broadband-enabled access point from a couple hundred feet to out to maybe 2 miles. And it's also extremely resilient because it's dynamic. It's constantly adding and removing nodes onto the mesh, and So if somebody moves out of range and comes back in, that also makes it extremely difficult to attack. Now, the problem with 802.11b is the frequency it uses. 2.4 gigahertz is, as we've already noticed, already used by a lot of noisy devices like cordless phones and microwaves cause interference. There is another band that was recently made available for non-commercial, non-licensed usage, I should say, which is up in the 5 gigahertz range. There is a wireless networking standard available for that. It's called 802.11a. It works almost exactly the same way. The protocols are very similar. The cards, the equipment, the access points look very similar. Up until a few months ago, you would pay a premium for the 802.11a equipment. Not anymore if you jump onto PriceWatch. Anybody here not heard of PriceWatch.com? It's a search engine for computer parts, basically, and systems. If you jump on a price watch and do a search on 802.11a access point or client card, you'll see that the prices have dropped down almost to the same range as 802.11b. You can pick up an 802.11a access point for about $300. You can pick up a card for about $80. Two problems with this right now, though. They don't interoperate. Nobody at the moment builds a network card that can run in both frequency ranges. So that means if you use 802.11a at home and 802.11b at work, you have to swap cards, which is irritating.
Does have one.
Yes, kind of. They have an access point that'll do that'll do both, but there isn't a client card that does both. The problem is it requires two different antennas, it requires two different radio stages because they're running at vastly different frequencies, all of which is a little hard to pack into something this size. So, but fear not, and you know, various companies, including D-Link, Linksys, Lucent, Cisco, and various others, are racing to get it there as soon as possible. Something else you should look for when shopping for a laptop is built-in Wi-Fi accessibility, and the best one is modular. Compaq has a very nice design where the Evo notebooks, it's a module that plugs onto the back of the screen. The current ones are USB connected. That may change in the future. But the reason for doing that is that you don't want to be locked into a particular technology if you're going to be using the laptop for the next few years. Incidentally, most of the built-in stuff, the antenna is in the screen part of the laptop because A, it's the highest point on the laptop, and B, it's approximately vertical, unlike the rest of it. So that's dealing with 802.11a. There are other standards out there, 802.11g and so forth. You can go look up the draft RFCs if you're really interested, that are looking to merge the two, that are looking to improve some of the security aspects of the protocol and so forth. Personally, I don't think they're going to go anywhere because 802.11b has kind of reached critical mass. Well, one other advantage of 802.11a, it's a lot faster. 802.11b runs at a maximum wire speed of about 11 megabits. Your usable bandwidth is typically down in the sort of 2 to 3 megabits level. 802.11a runs at up to 75. Usable is typically around about 50. So that's pretty much as fast as you're going to get on a wired 100 base T connection. Question?
Yeah.
Mike?
When do you think that they'll get a standard on all this? Like, what is the guesstimated time that they'll finally get a standard on everything? Because, you know, experimenting is all nice and all, but I mean, why spend $300 here and then pay, you know, $300 later for all that stuff?
Welcome to the technology shell game. You know, short of sort of telling you to do the cryo sleep thing, there isn't a good answer. Okay, it's just the way the technologies do evolve. Okay, unfortunately, this industry is littered with good technologies that didn't make it and pieces of crap that became popular because they were cheap first. Okay.
Is 802.11a any better about penetrating through like concrete walls and metal and brick? And are there any devices commonly used that interfere with it, like microwaves and cordless phones do with 802.11b?
No, there's very little other than some satellite bands up in that region that interfere. The problem is that 802.11a, although it's up in the 5 gig range, theoretically would have better penetration through more dense materials. They kind of compensated for that by dropping the allowable power that was available in that band. So thank you to the FCC for that one. The effective coverage is about the same. The short answer to your question is no. It's difficult to get signals through dense materials like cinder block, concrete, and whatever. The best you can do is get an external antenna and run a cable to the external antenna outside whatever's causing the interference on the other side of the wall. Okay, that's really the best you can do. And it's interesting, you can get connectivity in surprising ways. If you boost your sensitivity on reception, for example, with an antenna like this one, this is probably about as high gain as you can get. It's illegal to boost the power up beyond 100 milliwatts in the 2.4 gig band if you're broadcasting omnidirectional. Okay, in other words, if you're broadcasting everywhere. You can crank the power up a lot higher if you're broadcasting in a focused beam. Okay. So that's why you can't actually get 802.11b amplifiers. They're not cheap. They typically run anywhere from $500 to $700, and you'll need one both ends typically. But coupled with a directional antenna, yes, you can punch the signal through quite a lot that you typically can't. But even with a passive antenna like this is a 24 dB gain antenna. Anybody here not familiar with radio, reception is measured in decibels like any other signal. The higher the better, and it's logarithmic, not linear, but anyway. Suffice it to say that that's giving me quite a large boost in terms of receptive sensitivity. I found in an office building where I was working that this was a typical sort of concrete and steel framed building. There was a, I was one floor up from where their access points were, and with the typical omnidirectional antenna, a little pigtail, or certainly the built-in one on the laptop, I couldn't pick up their access points. However, if I plugged this beast in and pointed it at the stairwell, I got a perfectly usable signal. What was happening? They had an access point close to the stairwell, and the signal was ricocheting up the stairwell through the concrete floor and out the door at my level to an extent that was usable with a suitably sensitive antenna. So, you know, these are the sort of things that keep security managers up at night. And it's interesting, a lot of the corporate world is sort of like, well, how do I lock down a wireless network? The single best thing you can do if you do this in your working life is be very careful in terms of antenna placement, antenna design, and also transmit power. You know, the least power you can get to cover the floor that it's supposed to, changing the antenna design so that, for example, if you've got an access point on the corner of the building, you're not radiating out the building as well as into it. All these are fairly simple things that you can do. We're ready for time, Scott.
Yeah. I had a question.
Go.
How do you connect that antenna to a card? Is there an antenna jack?
Thank you. I knew there was something I wanted to say. There's a URL that I was hoping to pull up here in a minute. I'll try and do that as soon as I can get back connected to the base station. There's a company called Hyperlink Technologies. And their URL is hyperlinktech.com. And they are wonderful from the perspective that they're probably the only company that sells this kind of gear direct to the public and in single units. Everybody else sort of wants you to buy a couple hundred of the things. But to connect up to an external antenna with a regular card, you require what's called a pigtail. Okay. Kind of like your LAN adapter. In this case, it's got the teeny tiny dainty, very fragile connector on this end that plugs into the card, and typically something that'll handle the connection on this end, either an N-type or a BNC or something like that. And the way this works on the Lucent cards is, I don't know if I can get the stupid thing out, there's a little plug on here, there we go, that either requires a fingernail or a pin to get out. Plug that in, and now we're good to go. That's disabled the internal antenna, and now I'm free to pipe whatever signals I like into this. Incidentally, the pigtail just by itself provides about as good a reception as the built-in antenna. So that should tell you how good they are. You can build your own antenna. The infamous Pringles can design is probably one of the favorites if you go out on the web and go looking. How well do they work? Some of them work better than others. There was a guy who did a sort of bake-off of various antennas, found the Pringles cam was doing about 7 dB gain, which is not too shabby, and it's directional. Unfortunately, microwave antenna design is kind of a black art. You need some fairly sophisticated software to sort of map the design. You need to understand the physics behind it to create the antennas. Some of them are really weird. Like, for example, you want to make a vertical antenna with a specific pattern. One of the easiest ways to do it is to take a chunk of aluminum and put a specifically spaced set of holes in it. Like I said, you know, it's kind of the physics is kind of voodoo when it gets to that level. And I don't pretend to understand it, I just use it. So make your own antenna if you've got plenty of time. Hyperlink is not particularly expensive for antennas. A rubber duck, a little rubberized antenna that's about a 13 dB that's suitable for external mounting will go for about $40 to $50. This is a Hyperlink Tech that typically goes for like $110, but I bought it. They had them on sale for $60. You know, so watch the website. It's possible with unamplified signals with one of these on either end and a good clear line of sight to get 2.5 miles out of them. The biggest problem with that, anybody want to take a guess?
You have to aim it.
alignment, yes. You've got to be damn sure you can aim them straight. The other question that sometimes crops up with antennas and 802.11b signals is vertical and horizontal polarization. Doesn't particularly matter. Okay, try whichever works best for you. Try it in both orientations and see which one works best. One of the nice things about the hyperlink design is I can take this apart here and change the horn part around to change it from vertical to horizontal. So I can use the same parts. Question at the back there?
Yeah, I was just curious. Making your own antenna, what are the risks as far as load balancing that you can burn the card?
I wouldn't short the card, but you know, even if you do something like that, I wouldn't stick the antenna in the microwave. But apart from that, no, you're unlikely to blow anything. It just won't work if you get it wrong.
Yeah. As part of antenna design, you have other components in there, standing wave ratio, SWR. If your SWR is too high, you will reflect back in the transmitter and blow it out. So you have to be kind of careful about this. That goes back to that black art of antenna design.
That's correct, but the power levels here, are, as I said, are maximum 100 milliwatts, and the radio stages and the cards are fairly smart to protect against things like that. So to the best of my knowledge, I haven't heard of anybody blowing a card yet. But you're entirely correct, yes. There is a man who sounds like he knows more about radio than I do. Quick, grab him for antenna design.
Good question. I'm looking at, I'm not looking at, I'm going to be helping a local coffee shop that I tend to go to implement a wireless access point for their clientele through a local ISP. I won't mention who they are. What should I be worried about?
The first thing is I would worry about, is this going to be a public access point?
I think the idea is that they'll probably charge a nominal fee of like $5 for a month, knowing what the password is.
Okay. You might want to take a look at how the hotel and hospitality industry does it. A lot of hotels are setting up courtesy wireless networks for their guests and for conventioners. For some strange reason, this seems to be more prevalent on the West Coast than here, but you do a bit of war driving downtown in Atlanta, you'll pretty much see, I'm convinced that with a suitable antenna, we could probably reach the Swiss Hotel from low Earth orbit. They seem to have an access point on every floor of their building and every corner of every floor of their building, and some pretty good antennas on them too. You drive past the Swiss Hotel with the NetStumbler up, and it lights up like a Christmas tree. The way most hotels work is, and most people who offer public access for pay work, is that when you associate with their network, it's kind of like a private network like you would set up at home or in the office. So it's a 10.dot network or a 192.168.dot network, whatever, which provides you with a DHCP address, which lets you get on their network. And then you have to go through their firewall or their proxy to get connected to the internet. Typically, capture the first port 80 connection, throw up the login screen, and don't route anything to it. So that's a fairly well-established industry.
There's source ports.
Yeah, there's SourceForge software that can do that as well. I'm just trying to think, probably the best known company that does that for hotels is a company called LodgeNet. Okay, so if you're for that kind of environment, I would strongly recommend looking into that kind of access software. Really, the problem is no different than if you were offering, wired ports for public, for pay access. I mean, the software is exactly the same, the concept's exactly the same. The question about whether you should worry about running WEP on your network, the answer is probably not, because you don't want to confuse the customers more than you have to, some of whom are probably not as technically oriented as the rest of us. And that's just one more thing that could go wrong and scare them away. However, you have to balance that against the potential legal liability that if somebody decides to war drive and start hacking around on the open, the non-routed side of the network, their machines are vulnerable to that. So you probably want to put a clause to that effect in the piece of paper that they sign before they can get onto your network. Question on this side.
Hi, you mentioned that you have an access point set up that's connected to the outside right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be running during the hacking 201 panel tonight?
Yes. If you do, it is running. It is also running WEP. And if you do manage to crunch it, I would really like to know.
Not likely, but are you going to be at the panel?
Yes, I'll be on Hacking 201. And by the way, if you haven't heard Johnny X say this, Hacking 201, free beer. You have to ask a good question, though. Ask a bad question, we'll give you a bad beer. I was responsible for the bad beer today, and it's Milwaukee's Best Light. Delivered overhand. Question.
Yeah, when you enable the WEP, does it slow down the transmission?
If this was Hacking 201, that would be a beer question, because that's a good one. It depends on who you ask. It depends on how old the equipment is. It depends on the processing power. In theory, the whole reason for the two-tier WEP structure was the fact that the 40 or 64-bit encryption key did not slow down the processors that were available for embedded systems at the time. In practical terms, right now, most systems that are sold that are 128-bit capable, you won't notice a difference. You may notice a slight perceptible lag, but the processing speed, processing power has become so cheap now that you generally won't.
So it's using your computer to encrypt?
It's a combination. Inside the access point, it'll be the access point's processor. Inside your machine, no, it's a dedicated encryption chip in the card that is responsible for doing that. In most systems, I have seen a couple of very cheap cards that use the system processor for doing that. There are really two principal chipsets that are used for 802.11b cards. The Lucent one is called Hermes, as in the winged messenger god, and pretty much you only find that in Lucent equipment, Aguirre, Orinoco, Avaya, same thing. The other one is the Prism chipset, which is found in almost everything else. If you're a Linux user, FreeBSD user, it's important to know which chipset you have, because obviously the drivers are completely and utterly mutually incompatible. If you're a Windows user, use the drivers you got with the hardware. They work. Just go and download the most recent ones. So there's not a huge choice in terms of chipsets out there, and both of those two designs pretty much use the have built into them the facility to bolt on an external chip that costs the manufacturer maybe 50 cents to do the encryption scheme. So in practical terms, the answer is no, you won't notice a difference. Theoretically, yes, there is a small lag that's added to it. Any other questions? All right, if we're at that sort of point, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the equipment that you can buy for your home network and some of the pros and cons. How are we doing for time, Scott? Okay, good. Now, what I've got up here is probably what I would recommend as a typical setup for a home user. And in actual fact, this is my home setup. This is what I brought in. So my home is currently not wireless connected, and my wife has promised faithfully she won't get upset when you're trying to use a wireless equipped laptop this evening, because it's not going to go anywhere. That is a residential gateway, not just an access point. An access point really is nothing more or less than a bridge. It's just like an Ethernet bridge, except that one side of the Ethernet is wireless, the other side is wired. And bridges can be made fairly small and fairly cheap. So if all you want to do is connect, wireless equipped computers to an existing wired network, bridge type access points only are the cheapest option. However, most homes, you may or may not have an existing network. So the residential gateways offer a couple of nice features. One, they typically offer some kind of, rudimentary NAT translation, network address translation, so that you can have multiple computers sharing the same internet connection. This particular unit has not only an Ethernet port for broadband connectivity to DSL or cable modem, but it also has a regular phone jack. So does the Apple AirPort. So even if you only have dial-up at home, you might want to consider using your wireless access point as your primary gateway. They're cheap enough, they're simple enough. Most of them are administered with web-based interfaces now. or as I said, go download the corporate software, which typically does its management by SNMP. So, man, this cable's crappy. All right. So that's the difference between a residential gateway and an access point. Additionally, some of the residential gateways also incorporate a switch, typically no more than 4 ports. So an all-in-one device is a good choice for a lot of people who don't have a lot of existing network infrastructure at home, because it gives you 4 wired ports, it gives you your wireless access point, it gives you your outgoing network address translation, connection sharing, all for typically under $200 these days, okay, which is a pretty good deal. If, however, you have somewhat more ambitious needs, anybody here run more than 4 computers at home? Yeah, okay. So for those of you who run more than 4, you probably already have an existing set of switches, or at least hubs. You have an existing network. So for you, just a straight Ethernet bridge to be able to bridge your computers in is probably going to be a more cost-effective choice. Additionally, the other popular use for this is if you're anybody here a regular LAN party attendee, go around parties. Yeah, you're starting to see wireless networks show up at LAN parties. Yeah, even if they aren't, you know, if you want to bring your wireless card along and you know quake from the toilet or whatever, I mean, you know.
Just get yourself
a cheap access point. In actual fact, I've gone completely wireless now. I got tired of swapping between wireless and wired cards at the office and wireless at home. So I actually carry a small SMC access point. I bought this one not because it was the cheapest or because it was the fastest or best, but because it's physically quite small. It's the size of about 2 packs of playing cards with 2 antennas stuck on the side. And I keep that in my briefcase so that, you know, if I'm somewhere where I would normally have to plug a wired cable in, I can plug an access point. Yes, it's running web. Okay. And do check your employment contract carefully. Do check your company's policies carefully. In my particular case, it's not a violation if it's temporary and it's encrypted. Okay. But do exercise a little caution and common sense in that regard. In fact, it's quite a problem in corporate America, and it's one of the biggest reasons that IT managers fear war driving is basically the VP of marketing, you know, wanting to use his whiz-bang wireless built-in on his network, going out to CompUSA, dropping $200 on an access port, and sticking it behind his desk plugged into his wired connection. Gee, all those firewalls, gateways, and you know, DMZ zones that IT spent the last 2 years perfecting just suddenly became completely and utterly useless. Because anybody driving past there with a suitably equipped antenna can hop straight past them onto the network. So that's a couple of words of advice. Actual war driving itself, it's a good idea that you do this in 2-person teams. Okay, one person operates the computer, the other one drives. However, it is possible to just sort of like leave NetStumbler or AirSnort or whatever it is running and just sort of like drive around aimlessly. Do watch out for doing this at nighttime in areas where they have signs that say no cruising between the hours of whatever. There are people who've had problems with that. Secondarily, depending on how discreet you want to be about this, that's not discreet. Okay. You can get a 13 dB antenna that looks pretty much like a shark fin on the roof that's magnetically mounted, specifically designed for this kind of thing. And weatherproof. So, you know, that's that. Although I do quite well with this particular beast stuck in the front seat. You know, I just strap it down with the seat belt and point it out through the front window. The key point is to get the antenna outside the car, or in my case, pointing through the glass. You know, nobody ever bothers to tell you radio waves don't go through metal too well. Your car body, unless you're driving a Saturn, is made of steel. Yes, at the back there, Mike Boy. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's only the door panels.
There is another factor.
Yeah.
You have a metallicized window tint.
Yeah. That's also bad. Yep. Mike, brother, question. Yeah, so, you know, experiment in your driveway to see where you get the best, you know, reception. Most NA211 software comes with, you know, a little meter of some kind that'll show you signal strength, like this one. And as you saw, NetStumbler itself has that nice little time domain graph. It'll also, if you choose to add a GPS, it'll log the GPS coordinates of each access point you pick up, or rather where you are when it picks it up. And you can go onto the site and see, you know, people are basically contributing to a public database of access points. So they're effectively mapping the 802.11b world. Question?
Actually, just a statement. If you own a GM vehicle made after 1995 with those nice dark back windows, those are tinted with lead. So don't try aiming out the back windows of your vehicle either.
That should be fun. Yeah, actually, we're planning on trying an experiment. There's a HackerCon in Tennessee, Freaknik. When is Freaknik this year? Still Halloween weekend?
Yeah,
Freaknik.org. P-H-R-E-A-K-N-I-C. And so a bunch of us from Atlanta will be driving up there. We have ambitions of having, you know, the world's first 70-mile-an-hour wireless network. You know, going to see how many AC converters we can stuff into a minivan and have people quaking on the go.
It's been done already.
Yeah.
From Pittsburgh to St. Louis.
Did they game?
Yeah, they were doing games cool. In IRC, and one of the reasons using a cell phone to connect up to the internet. So
yeah.
Did that turn
oh, damn. All right. Yeah. So it's a good idea. So we're going to give that a try.
Two questions for you, or at least looking for your comments. One of the things you were talking about for 802.11 security, the company I work for has said that you must use Cisco cards, and they tie them down by MAC addresses. So if you're outside and trying to come in, there's evidently some level of encryption, if you can kind of talk to that a little bit.
Okay. Once you step outside of the consumer realm into the sort of pro type access point equipment, you know, the stuff that costs twice the price, there are a couple of things you can do to improve security. One is to do MAC-level address filtering. Even a lot of the home consumer stuff starts to support that now, which effectively will deny access except to a list of known MAC addresses. That's typically beyond the average home user to set up. Probably most people in this room could get it right, though. The downside to that is, obviously, the access point has to maintain a list of known good MAC addresses. Now you can imagine across a nationwide or international enterprise how many computers there are, how big that list address is. Oh, we're starting to get into the our host's file is too big problem again. So there are various proprietary DNS-like distributed databases for doing this. That's one thing. And the other is there are various proprietary extensions to 802.11b that are not interoperable and peculiar to a particular vendor that can be used to increase security. Lucent/Aguirre/Orinoco/etc. Has one, and so does Cisco. 3Com has some, and basically, you know, if you like buying all of your network equipment from one vendor, by all means, turn it on. In fact, I do this at home because my cards are Lucent and my access point is Lucent. I can use the proprietary flag, which not only shields my name from being broadcast, it also means if you don't have a Lucent card, you can't associate with my network because it changes the protocol slightly. Really, what it's changing is something to do with fragmentation algorithms and a couple of other things. So.
One last one is, you mentioned NetStumbler as one tool that might be used. What other tools out there have you had success or would suggest people looking into for this type of activity?
For the sniffing? Really, the two are, if you're in Windows, NetStumbler. If you're in any of the Linux or free Unixes, AirSnort. I'm not a Mac person,
Mac
Randall. What is it?
MacStumbler.
MaxStumbler, yes, I know. I thought they ported it. There's also a version of NetStumbler that runs on certain Windows CE Palm Tops, which can be equipped with wireless access cards, because these days you can find, you can get 802.11b cards in the compact flash form factor, which is found on Palm Tops. In actual fact, that seems to be becoming the sniffer of choice for corporate IT. Oh, there's one right at the back there. Thank you. Okay, so we got two. Cool. Yes.
Two questions. One, is the MAC address encrypted?
No.
So this MAC filtering is essentially worthless. You just sniff the network, and in 10 seconds, you pick a MAC address, torpedo the computer if you want to be vindictive, and then just use its MAC address?
You can spoof it very easily, okay. Yes. Unless it's running web, which is encrypting the wire, but yes.
So
unless you're running web, no, it's not. The MAC is not specifically encrypted across the network. It couldn't be.
Second question, do you see any trends in the near future, say next, you know, two to five years, of somebody actually using decent security for wireless, or is it all going to be you use SSH or VPN if you care?
My day job, I'm a systems architect, so you're trespassing onto my day job when I say that.
From a design perspective,
it's actually probably better that the security is handled at a higher level. I prefer that programmers, customers, clients, and people in general regard networks as insecure things and don't trust them. And I tend to personally view any wire-level encryption, whether it's happening over wire or radio waves, as a bonus. Because from a security standpoint, all that's going to do is slow people down. It's not really designed to stop anybody. So I think you're going to see it continue much as before. There is some work that's going into the newer standards in terms of increasing the number of bits that are used for the wired equivalency privacy protocol. There is some work going into changing the algorithms or making them user selectable. But you should regard any network as inherently insecure, and if you're shipping secure data across it, and really you should regard almost everything as secure data, you should be encrypting it at a higher level. SSH is a great tool. It's commonly available on almost every damn thing with a processor these days. you can run a virtual private network, a tunnel, an encrypted tunnel through there. There's free software for doing that. There's, you know, even free Windows software for doing that these days, by God.
Question at the back there.
Yeah, just a comment, actually. If you're looking for other NetStumbler-like software for free Unixes, there's also one called Kismet.
Oh, yes.
True.
Oh, I should also mention Kismet and AirSnort are a little more sophisticated than NetStumbler and the MaxStumblers. Those NetStumbler and MaxStumblers really just look for beaconing addresses. The AirSnort and Kismet tools actually will look for packets flying backwards and forwards and will pick up even non-beaconing systems if somebody's talking to them. So, you know, levels of security. Is there a question over there? I guess the other comment I would say is, you know, is this stuff secure enough for, you know, my grandmother to be using it, my mother to be using it? Probably, if it's set up properly.
Is there a tool I can use to spoof a MAC address on a wireless device?
I plead the fifth. This is being recorded. That's probably a question better asked of Hacking 201. The short answer is yes. All right. I think we're done. Any other questions?